I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Charlotte, North Carolina will get their city back tomorrow after the Democrats leave town following their three-day national convention. Life is getting back to normal in Tampa, Florida, a week after the Republicans concluded their nominating convention. So who pays for these party events? The money comes from a variety of sources, from corporate donors to taxpayers. Our guest, Dave Leventhal, tracks money and politics for Politico. He was editor of OpenSecrets.org at the Center for Responsive Politics, and before that spent 7 years at the Dallas Morning News. And Dave Leventhal, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
And to our listeners, any questions or comments you might have, 1-888-477-9499. Dave, do we know the price tag for these two conventions this year?
We do. At least at this stage of the game, we can tell that there were about $18 million in public funding that went to each convention, about $50 million in Homeland Security money that, of course, went for the very, very tight security that's involved with both. The thing that we're still trying to get our minds around is the corporate money that has gone into both conventions, in different forms, mind you, but still tens and tens of millions of dollars of outside money that's come into the conventions that we won't have a full picture of in bottom line until about October of this year.
Is that when they have to disclose how much was spent?
The middle of the month next year is when they have to disclose, and we have a window into both conventions to see and be able to tell that there definitely have been some major contributions, as there have been in conventions before, from notable corporations, banks, financial institutions, transportation outfits, pretty much big names that everyone around the country would easily recognize. But they don't have to disclose exactly how much they're giving in full, again, until the middle of next month. So all that money is being spent today, but we'll know about it tomorrow.
Let's talk about that $18 million in public funds. Taxpayers get to check off a little box on their tax form.
They do. And so when you fill out your tax form, you have the option to basically pay into a fund that the conventions can draw from in order to have the central core functions of the convention actually be conducted. This is the same type of money that's used for the now effectively defunct presidential public financing system that really went the way of the dodo in 2008 when Barack Obama himself decided to opt out of it. And as a result, John McCain is the last major presidential candidate to actually use this type of money, because neither Barack Obama nor Mitt Romney have used it in 2012. So the public definitely still has the option to do this going forward, but there's a whole lot of speculation as to whether the conventions are going to change markedly, and the funding for them is going to change markedly, in part because a lot of politicians themselves have been very upset about the type of money that has been going into the conventions in the first place.
And I want to pick up on that. How many Americans check that little box?
I don't know off the top of my head how many do, but certainly it's enough to have a very, very sizable fund. They had no problem, either the Democrats or the Republicans, drawing the requisite amount of money that they needed from this fund to go forward and, again, do those central core convention elements that this money is funding, and that's actually the throwing of the convention itself. When we talk about corporate money, when we talk about this outside money, that's not actually funding the exact convention in and of itself. It's funding sort of these secondary and ancillary events that are very much within the orbit of the convention, but not something that is going to be paying for example, the stage on which Barack Obama or Mitt Romney is going to speak.
But are you talking about that money also paying for parties and cruises and golfing outings, things like that?
Oh, without question. And some of the money that doesn't even get reported, or there's plenty of money that doesn't even get reported, that doesn't have to get reported, that's funding private affairs and all of these lavish parties and golfing outings, as you said, and some very creative ones, too, concerts. We've had boat trips and the whole nine yards. You know, really, when you go to a convention, and the attraction for a lot of people for going to these conventions, if you're not a delegate, is that they're sort of like Washington, D.C. rolled up and compacted into a few square blocks, either in Tampa or Charlotte. And as a result, you sort of get this concentrated power where politicians and lobbyists, operatives, activists are all together, all in the same place. You can rub shoulders with them about as easy as any place on earth. And for people who want to get their policy issue or their political position or philosophy in the mix of the most powerful people really in this country, this is about as good a place as any to do it.
Let me pick up on something you referenced earlier, that there are some efforts to, I guess, prevent some of this public money, this 18, I guess it would be about $36 million, going to these party events. What's the criticism?
There was a bill actually back in July, or rather in June, that went forward and then was quickly batted back, that said, you know, we should get rid of public funding altogether, that conventions should be smaller, that there's really no purpose for a 3 or 4 day PR festival for the parties, and all of the real business that needs to be done could be done in a very short period of time, even a matter of hours. 1 day would be fine. Now, 4 years from now, we may be having a conversation like this, where things are markedly different, but at least at this stage of the game, there has been no definitive effort to actually end conventions the way they are. When it comes to the outside money, Democrats have this year been very aggressive in saying we are not going to accept corporate money. And technically speaking, they're right. They didn't accept corporate money for a nonprofit organization that they had set up to go ahead and again conduct these ancillary events. What they did do was sort of an end around. A nonprofit corporation is being helped by another nonprofit corporation, and as a result of that, they're taking in money from some notable names, Bank of America and Wells Fargo and AT&T and various others, a lobbying firm even, and it's sort of a step away from doing it the way that the Republicans are, but still it's opened the Democrats up to a lot of criticism from good government-type folks who've said, hey, this is really disingenuous, and you're saying that you're trying to run the People's Convention, an open convention, a transparent convention, and in our opinion, you're doing nothing of the sort.
Looking at these nonprofits, do they have to disclose donors? Do they have to disclose how much these donors are giving to these conventions?
As nonprofit operations, they will have to disclose a certain amount, but it's going to come well after the fact of the convention itself. Right. It's not going to be instantaneous, and part of the criticism that's been leveled at Democrats is that they had promised in months past that any outside money that was coming in was going to be something that would be transparent, that they would post it on their website, that sponsors of any types of events related to the convention would be open and available for people to see. Well, that didn't come to pass. So as a result, Democrats are, again, being criticized for this type of activity that didn't, in the end, meet up with the types of messages that they were sending months ago, well before the convention actually took place.
Did the Citizens United decision then affect how these conventions are funded and how the money is given to each of the parties and conventions?
The Citizens United case is actually a separate issue from the conventions. It really didn't have much of an effect on the way that the conventions themselves are being operated, but it very much has an effect on the way that the elections themselves are being funded and operated. And a lot of the folks who have benefited from the Citizens United decision, the super PACs, the outside nonprofit groups, and even corporations themselves have been very, very active participants in many cases in both conventions. And we've seen plenty of faces, particularly on the Republican side, big dollar donors, people like Sheldon Adelson, the casino mogul, people like David Koch, the oil billionaire who has been one of the biggest political donors to Republican causes this year, both at the Republican National Convention. It's been interesting on the Democratic side, and of course the Democrats have struggled to raise the type of big dollars that the Republicans have this election cycle. They haven't seen as many faces. People like George Soros, who is a longtime Democratic backer and fundraiser, he's not at the convention, and perhaps that speaks a little bit to the financial malaise that the Democrats are experiencing this election cycle with their inability to match dollar for dollar the outside big money that's flowing into this election.
Picking up on what you said, and it looked like a bipartisan effort to get this federal money out of conventions, the argument being that these are propaganda or PR events, is the other argument that this is about party building, it's about democracy, it's about our election system?
That's absolutely the counterpoint. And people who are defending the conventions as they are or defending the relevance of the convention will say, hey, this is not the same game that we had 40 or 50 years ago when you might have a floor fight, you might have a battle for actually who is going to be the nominee. These smoky back rooms were well and active at that point. Not the same game. However, they will argue that it's incredibly important, because if you are going to party build, if you are going to get your team together, if you are going to rally behind your candidate, this is the time to do it, and this is the venue to do it in. And as everyone has seen who's watched the conventions, both conventions have been opportunities to do just that, perhaps to greater or lesser effect than some would wish, but at the end of the day, it is still an opportunity and the best available for both parties to launch themselves into the final home stretch going toward Election Day in November.
But without those public monies, then conventions would be wholly dependent then on private funders, would they not?
And that's the very reason that public money was involved in the first place, because a decision was made back in the 70s, back when Watergate was de jure, that this was something that was just not acceptable, having corporate interests actually fund the conventions themselves. Of course, there were loopholes and end-arounds that have been done in the interim between then and now, in which corporations were able to have a very major role. And both parties have done this. This is not unique to one party or another. But at the end of the day, the idea behind public funding and sort of the pushback of it now is that these conventions just need to be fundamentally reimagined, and that you should not be having conventions as long and as lavish as they continue to be today.
Looking at this public money, and we will talk about the private money as well, but looking at it specifically, is that when we see balloons drop, apparently it's not going to happen tonight in Charlotte, but it did happen in Tampa. Is that money where does the public money go? Are there certain places it's allowed to go, certain places it can't go?
Sure, and there are a whole set of rules and regulations that govern where it can go. And again, we won't have a full picture as to where this year's conventions or the two conventions this year have spent their money until October. What we do know at this point is that travel, production costs, media, even the funding of employees and the taxes that are paid on their payroll, this is the type of money that is being spent using public dollars in order to actually kick these conventions off. There are other things, too, like insurance and even the websites, the IT service, legal services. You could kind of go down the list as to what exactly is being paid for by these public dollars. But usually they're expenses that are not going to jump out at people as being really far out, but something that is just going to involve the basic functions of putting on a big party and putting on a big show like these conventions are.
And we're almost up on a break here, but no big lavish breakfast part of the public tab?
In the past, we have seen food, and we have seen catering definitely factor into that. It's not something that is one of the top expenses, but it definitely is in the mix, at least at some level. So, yes.
Well, we are talking about money and politics with Dave Leventhal in this first half of Radio Times today. He tracks money and politics for Politico. He was editor of OpenSecrets.org at the Center for Responsive Politics. And before that, he spent 7 years at the Dallas Morning News. Lines open. Any questions or comments? 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
A stroke can rob us of our ability to speak, to move, to understand. The new Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital uses an interventional approach to the rapid treatment of stroke and aneurysm. Formed in collaboration with stroke experts from Jefferson's Faculty Practice Plan and the Jefferson Neuroscience Network, they use minimally invasive techniques to avoid open brain surgery, to prevent disabilities, and to save lives. The Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital supports WHYY.
I'm Ray Suarez. Coming up on America Abroad,
the number one thing that either Obama or Romney needs to do to help the world is to help the American economy.
4% of Americans believe that foreign affairs is an important part of the campaign decision for them this year.
The next president, foreign policy challenges on the next America Abroad from Public Radio International.
Tomorrow night at 11 on WHYY.
As befits a star of his party, former President Bill Clinton has a leading role at the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte. We'll take a closer look at what Clinton's big moment means for President Obama and whether it could help the president and the party win over undecided voters. That's next time on Tell Me More.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Dave Leventhal, money and politics reporter for Politico. We're talking about the money that has been invested flowing into the national conventions. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Dave, you said part of the cost of these conventions, $50 million for security. That's an astounding number.
And it's a necessary number, at least as far as the federal government is concerned. Of course, you've just got to look at who's actually at these conventions. And when you have former presidents and current presidents and first ladies and vice presidents and quite literally hundreds of current and former members of Congress, this is about as big a gathering, politically speaking, as you're going to find. Maybe the State of the Union address every year is going to rival that. Maybe inauguration will trump it. But short of that, this is about as much security as you're going to need for a public event. And with dozens of exits and entrances, and so many people who are involved there who are just coming to watch or participate as a delegate. It's so many variables, and you quite literally need hundreds, even thousands of people who are keeping watch.
Are you down there, Dave? I'm embarrassed to say it. Are you in Charlotte as we're talking?
I am back in D.C.
Okay,
but,
you were there.
From the sound of everything that's going on today, there are literally 15,000 different journalists and bloggers and other media members who are participating. So it's something where quite literally there are tens upon tens of thousands of people who flock in and flock right back out for conventions such as this.
And we're going to be talking about that in the second half of the hour. Let me get to actually Tim from, looks like Ridefield Park, to join us. Tim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi.
Hi there.
I think this whole process of the conventions for both the Republicans and the Democrats is a big waste of time, money, and effort. I mean, they were set up years and years ago when there was no social media, not too many televisions in the country. People, the only way they can get their news on these candidates was by this one big convention. But with the social media today, you know, I think it's the whole thing is unneeded. And I'm one of those people that check the box on my taxes, and I would love to know the exact number, how many people that actually do that.
And Tim, are you going to continue to do that or not?
Well, you know, now that I know that the money is not being spent in the right way, I may not. I don't know what happens to that money. You just talked about both Obama and Romney didn't use that money. McCain was the last person to use it. If that's the case, what happens to it? Where does it go?
Yeah, and there's several boxes I think we're talking about. But Tim, I appreciate the call. Let me give Dave a chance to respond. Dave, go ahead.
I've talked to plenty of people who've had similar sentiments saying, hey, I'm sitting watching television for 3 days in a row, and then the next week for another 3 days in a row, and all this is a bunch of speeches. I can hear these speeches in other forums. I can go on YouTube and watch these candidates talk if I want to. There's so many other venues for me to participate as a voter or to gather information as a voter. Why do I need these? So it's sort of a rhetorical question I'm offering up here, but one that's very much on the minds of a lot of voters who just kind of scratching their head saying, all right, well, there's some interesting stuff that I'm hearing, but do I really need to be helping pay millions upon millions of dollars to fund it in the first place? And do we need to be putting so many resources and efforts, particularly when you're talking about security, particularly when you're talking about all the outside events? It may be a waste of money in a lot of people's minds.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Tim, you can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Dave, I keep circling back, but let me go back to something you said earlier. Both parties then have set up these nonprofits to help them fund the conventions. The Democrats seem to have slightly different rules compared to the Republicans. But how does that work?
Well, without getting too deep into the technical weeds of how this works, basically what the Democrats have done is they've set up a host committee, and this is standard practice for both parties. The host committee takes care of a whole bunch of the outside events and everything that is not, again, part and parcel paid for by public money. But what happened this time is that the Charlotte host committee set up another entity. It's called New American City, and it's a group that's basically been set up to take corporate cash from, again, we've mentioned a few of them, Bank of America, mm-hmm. Wells Fargo, Duke Energy, U.S. Airways, the airline, and they've taken in money to do a whole bunch of the outside events that, that again, are not part and parcel of the convention. I sound like a broken record here, but mm-hmm. are still giving these corporations plenty of opportunity to put their logos up on tents and events and very much be part of the convention and be have a prominent role in the convention. And, you know, even as these corporations have been solicited for the money that they've ultimately donated, it's been billed as such that it gives them an opportunity to really have a high-profile role during the convention events without actually playing quite as intimate a role as they might have if they were doing the same for Republicans. And in some cases, some gave money to both the Republican and the Democratic affairs.
They what they get for their money is, as you said, their name in perhaps in prime time. They get access as well. We actually covered the Republican convention in 2000. Seems like ancient history when it was in Philadelphia, and just a tiny glimpse, kind of behind the scenes there, as you referenced earlier, the amount of kind of hobnobbing and shoulder rubbing and conversation, cocktail parties. I have to say, was pretty shocking.
And when you have the most important people, politically speaking, in America, all together, all in the same place, if you can put your corporate logo up there, even if you are not paying for the event and the convention itself, that's still of great value to you, corporately speaking. Mm-hmm. And that's what these corporations or unions or other special interests want at the end of the day. They want to be visible. They want to reach out. They want to make a connection. And this is one of the many ways that they are able to do it and do it during conventions, Republican or Democrat.
And they want their 10 minutes with a high-profile politician?
Without question.
There's also a shadow convention, we should say, happening. They obviously don't get nearly the press attention, nor do they get the kind of funding and visitors and high profile that the two-party conventions get. Anything you want to say about that, Dave?
There are a whole bunch of other types of outside groups or outside shadow conventions. Ron Paul, in fact, had a rally that very much kind of worked like a little mini shadow convention to get his supporters all up in arms and very active. So definitely when it comes to special interest groups, when it comes to other organizations that are using this as an opportunity to tout their positions and tout their politics, this is a great one for them because they have a captive audience already assembling there, and they can grab those people, they can get those people interested, attract them with what they're doing, and be able to kind of operate, as you suggested, as a shadow or mini convention in and of themselves.
Let me get to Irv from Cherry Hill to join our conversation. Irv, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. I'm sure this is not a unique comment. However, I'm getting sick and tired of the marketing of presidents. I'm surprised that they don't say at the end of any of their pitches, but wait, there's more. I wonder if there's ever been an effort to say to candidates, okay, you're going to have perhaps four opportunities to present your views. Let the FCC take care of that. Perhaps they can the funding could come through with the federal government. And leave it at that, rather than give the candidates an opportunity to blast us with the same rhetoric and at times perhaps stick their tongues out at their opponents. I'm just curious if there's been any effort made to control the amount of time spent, literally and figuratively, on the media.
Dave, thanks. Irv, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Dave, you want to take that?
Quite the opposite is actually happening this election cycle. Instead of there being more limitations put in place, it's actually become much more of a laissez-faire situation where candidates and, of course, these outside groups, the nonprofits, the super PACs that can raise and spend unlimited sums of money are very much doing so, and they're going ahead with the free and full ability to put as many television ads and radio ads and internet ads up as possible. So if you live in a swing state and Philadelphia, the area is definitely going to get bombarded with messages as well. You are absolutely going to see more television and radio ads about candidates than you probably ever have in your entire life because of the rules being what they are. And when groups can raise and spend unlimited sums of money, and they can obviously do more, much more than they have in previous election cycles, and on both sides, but particularly the Republican side, they have the fuel and the funding to do just that and expect nothing but that between now and November.
Irv, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Dave Leventhal, thank you for joining us on Radio Times once again.
It's been my pleasure.
And he tracks money and politics for Politico. He was editor of OpenSecrets.org at the Center for Responsive Politics. Well, journalists and fact checkers have been kept busy this election season, vetting speeches and interviews by the candidates. Next, in this second half of Radio Times, are reporters doing a good enough job covering and refuting false claims by candidate speakers and some of their surrogates? And joining us is Justin Peters, editor-at-large for Columbia Journalism Review, where he's been writing about fact-checkers. He worked at Washington Monthly and has written for Slate, the Boston Globe, and the New York Times. And Justin Peters, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Let me begin with actually a piece you had in the Columbia Journalism Review. It's headline, Stupid Hat Tricks. And you... I won't steal your thunder here, but I see a picture of you with a very strange hat on. Tell us why you bought this hat and what happened.
Well, the other day I was in the lobby of the Time Warner Center right before the convention was getting started, and I noticed that the only people who seemed to be getting interviewed by the innumerable camera crews who were walking around were wearing ridiculous hats. People who had these gigantic Uncle Sam hats, or people who were wearing Robin Hood hats, or stuff that was better suited to some child's costume party, which struck me as sort of a hacky sort of thing that they teach you not to do in journalism school. Don't just run after the most obvious and dramatic people who are begging to be interviewed. So I wanted to test this, so I drove to a party city about 20 minutes on the outskirts of Charlotte, bought this ludicrous crown.
Yeah, kind of a kingly-looking or a monarchy-looking hat.
Like something you'd get at a cut-rate medieval times one of the actors would be wearing there.
Exactly.
And I went back to the Time Warner Center and put it on just to test out and see if anyone would come up and interview me. And I got interviewed three times in an hour by three different outlets. And I was just walking around wearing this crown. And it was sort of an interesting experiment to see how eager reporters actually were to interview someone who might look interesting but actually had nothing to say.
Does that tell us something about these conventions? And I don't know what the exact number is, but something like 12 to 15,000 journalists in various, I guess, stripes and persuasions covering these conventions.
Yeah, I mean, reporters love spectacle. They always have, and they always will. They're drawn to events and personalities that are big and loud and larger than life because these are easy stories to write because there's obvious things happening there. And, you know, it might play well on page one and on the nightly news, but often when everyone is going after the same big angles and big stories, nuance often gets neglected. So, yeah, in that way, I think reporters rushing to interview people with stupid hats is sort of a metaphor for the entire convention reporting process.
And that's Justin Peters, editor-at-large for Columbia Journalism Review. We are talking about the conventions and the press coverage of the conventions and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to talk about fact-checking, and there's been a fair amount of fact-checking at the conventions, I think some better than others. This is something that you have written about as well. How well would you say, and this is broadly speaking, the press has done fact-checking what some of the speakers have said?
I mean, I think there's been more of an effort to fact-check what the speakers have said during this campaign cycle than in any campaign cycle before. You've got dedicated fact-checking operations at a lot of newspapers and other journalism outlets. You've got PolitiFact, you've got factcheck.org, you've got people at the Washington Post and other papers whose only job or whose main job is to, as fast as they can, test the assertions that are being made in the politician statements and put their verdicts up online or in the newspaper as quick as they can. So there's a lot of effort being expended on these fact checks. I think the question really is, what sort of effect are they having? And, you know, to that, I really don't know. I don't know if they're having much of an effect, and I know that that is a question that a lot of journalists and observers are asking themselves. Do we actually sort of live in a post-fact society where no matter how much journalists and other observers try to hold politicians accountable for their words and the things they're saying, that the sort of velocity of the news cycle is such that misstatements, exaggerations, and false assertions just will pass unnoticed?
Well, it's interesting, and I'm interested that you use those words, because what I see, and I would include myself in this, is finding the right when someone says something that is untrue. Do you call it a lie? Do you call it a misstatement? Do you call it a false statement? Do you call it incorrect? And I see journalists struggling trying to find that correct word. Are you struggling as well, and is this an important struggle to have?
I think it is an important struggle to have, and I think it's important that journalists and other people who want to keep politicians honest, you know, think seriously about the terminology they use, because that's what fact-checking is essentially all about, holding people accountable for the words they use. Now, you know, when you're fact-checking, it's rarely so simple as someone says, the moon is made of butter.
Right.
And you can say, no, the moon is not. It's made of rocks. You know, it's mostly a lot more subtle than that. A politician will very rarely go up and say something that is completely false. Instead, you'll have something like, for example, the Republican vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan, in his speech on Wednesday night at the RNC, said that President Obama had rejected a report that had been issued by a bipartisan debt commission.
The Simpson-Bowles,
The Simpson-Bowles Commission. That's not necessarily a misstatement. It's more misleading, because what Ryan didn't say was that he was also a part of that commission, and he also rejected the report because he thought it was insufficiently tough on cutting spending. So you see more and more things like that, where the actual words the politician are saying might not be untrue, but the implications and the stuff that was omitted, it sort of renders the things that were said, it's very complicated. And I think this might be why some writers have a hard time figuring out what to do with statements like that.
Well, Justin, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Justin Peters, editor-at-large for Columbia Journalism Review. He's been writing about fact-checkers, and we are talking about fact-checking the fact-checkers who fact-check the speakers at these conventions. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Chemical Heritage Foundation, Library, Museum, Center for Scholars, supports WHYY. This first Friday, September 7th, CHF examines the art and science of herbal medicine, from folk traditions to current wisdom. Visitors can learn about varieties and uses of medicinal herbs and watch a live demonstration from Herbiary, a Philadelphia purveyor of organic plant medicines. CHF's newest exhibit, The Alchemical Quest, will also be on display. More online at chemheritage.org/firstfridays.
On the next Fresh Air, life in an assisted living facility when you're decades younger than the average resident. We talk with Martin Bain. He moved into an assisted living facility 8 years ago in his mid-50s as a result of young-onset Parkinson's disease. A former journalist and Zen monk, he now publishes a literary journal featuring writers in their 60s and older. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Banking is big in Charlotte, but it also falls hard. We'll see how an incubator hopes to broaden the city's business base. And a top Charlotte chef opens up a restaurant run by the homeless. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about fact-checking during this very contentious election season and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Justin Peters is our guest. Let me quote something, and I have to say, I looked at some of the fact-checking for Clinton's speech last night and some of the fact-checking for the Democrats speaking in Charlotte, and I have to say that none of them have come up to or come down to the kind of criticism that Paul Ryan got at his speech at the Republican National Convention. But interestingly, after his speech, the New York Times headline read, "Ryan's speech contained a litany of falsehoods." Fox contributor, a woman named Sally Cohn, said it was an apparent attempt to set the world record for the greatest number of lies and misrepresentations slipped into a single political speech. So it looks like at least some commentators are willing and want to call out a lie or misrepresentation when they see one.
Well, yes, some commentators are willing, but it's interesting you mentioned the New York Times piece, because that was actually, if I remember correctly, a second day story that ran on Friday, and the main account that ran Thursday, the day after Ryan spoke, was just a basic, straightforward telling of what happened with the speech. And it wasn't until, I believe, the 17th paragraph, somewhere buried deep beyond the jump, that the writer actually mentioned that Ryan's speech was misleading in parts. And, you know, that same thing happened with most of the day one accounts from the major papers across the country. And that is something that I think about a lot and that I've written about, the way that journalists and editors want to perhaps artificially separate fact-checking from straight news reporting, that they will put these fact-checking things on blogs, in opinion columns, and on second-day pieces that run deep inside the paper. The Times piece you mentioned ran on A13, I believe. But the story that's going to run on the front page that everyone's going to read barely mentions this sort of thing. And I think that might be a problem, actually.
Well, let me pick up on that, because, you know, in my fairy tale world, the part of an important job of journalists is to be truth tellers, or at least to get to as close to that as you can. And I've heard others, I won't claim originality on this, but some concern that fact-checking has been outsourced to PolitiFact, to factcheck.org, and to other, maybe even, specific columnists or reporters in papers, and that the regular everyday journalist says on this hand and then on the other hand. Does that concern you?
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's concerned me for a long time, and I think you're right. I think there's this crippling fear on the part of many journalists that they will be accused of bias if they state something that might be taken as an opinion in a story. And there's so many editors out there that have come up through the tradition of, listen, just the facts. We report what happened, we get some reaction quotes, and we let the columnists and other people deal with opinion. But more and more, you know, it's not really opinion talking about the lies that politicians are telling. When a politician, a major politician, addresses a national audience and salts his or her speech with half-truths, exaggerations, and misstatements, that is news, you know, and that is something that I believe at least the major news stories reporting on these speeches need to mention, and need to mention high up in the stories that are being published, to contextualize it for the public who is reading these things, and to let them know that listen, it's not just all political theater and how this speech will play with the voters. That the consistent sort of disregard for fact on both sides too is something that needs to be addressed.
Well, and when you use the word, I mean, if someone lies, it is willful. Is that you are not just misrepresenting something, or maybe not understanding something, and not even holding back something. You're lying.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I mean, this ideally is the role of the political press, to be adversarial towards politicians, to try to stop them from deceiving the public, because that's essentially the point. You can put, it might not be easy to use words like deception, but mm-hmm. I mean, that's, politicians want to get as many votes as possible, and they, I think on both sides, when they speak, are generally betting that the public is not going to be ambitious enough to go out and check their claims. And I think it really does fall to journalists to do that, and I wish they did it more.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking with Justin Peters, editor-at-large for Columbia Journalism Review. He's been writing about fact-checking and the political campaigns, the election this year. Let me see what Laura from Havertown has to say. Laura, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to say that I agree a lot with what Justin is saying, and I think that it's so important now that the journalists make it clear what's true and what's false, because I think as a general public, we really need to think a lot more before we cast our votes.
Justin, you want to add to that?
Oh, yeah, right on, Laura. I think you're absolutely right, and I'll go back to something I was saying a little bit earlier about the velocity of the news cycle these days. 10 years ago, everyone was wringing their hands over the 24-hour news cycle. Now it's more like a 24-second news cycle. Stories come and go, things are said, and then more things are said. They're sort of dissected on Twitter, on Facebook, on myriad blogs, and I think it really is all that a lot of citizens can do just to keep up with the deluge of information, let alone figure out what's right and what's wrong. And, I mean, this is sort of why I've been writing that if you're covering, as a journalist, political events like this, more and more I think it's incumbent on you to make it clear in every piece that you write high up so people don't miss it, the truth of what the politicians you're covering are saying, not just leave it to PolitiFact or whoever else out there is supposed to be in charge of that sort of thing.
Laura, thanks for the call. Let's see what Kate from Moorestown has to say. And Kate, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. There is
a term in the air today called truthiness, which means putting out what sounds like it's plausibly true, possibly even the words could be construed as true, but it does not convey the actual situation that you're talking about. There exists in our life right now a standard that politicians should need to look to and face and learn from. At West Point, there's a term for this truthiness concept. The word is quibbling, Q-U-I-B-B-L-I-N-G.
Sure.
If you quibble at West Point, you're trying to convey something with technically true words, but trying to convey something that isn't what you're saying it is. And if you do that at West Point, you're thrown out. All our politicians quibble. And I wonder why we're allowing our politicians, why we're holding them to a different standard. They're all bottom feeding, and we're letting them do it.
Well, Kate, that's a very interesting point. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Justin, any response to what she just said?
I mean, it would be nice if we could expel politicians for quibbling, but, I mean, then we'd be left with an empty Capitol building and no one on Air Force One. But no, I think she's absolutely right. And honestly, hate to sound like a broken record, but it does come down to journalists, I think, to play the role of the West Point administrators and call out politicians and other political figures who are quibbling or who are otherwise taking liberties with the truth. And that's not necessarily to say that doing so is always going to have an effect. I mean, it's quite obvious that a lot of times it doesn't. About a month ago, the Romney campaign responded to a fact check about a misleading ad they ran about Obama's ostensible cut of the welfare to work requirement by saying, nope, sorry, we're going to keep on running the ad because fact-checking has jumped the shark. And when you're faced with in attitudes like that, I think there's two ways you can go. You can throw up your hands and say, what's the point? And then just go interview people with stupid hats. Or you can get your dander up and say, well, you know, the point is that as journalists writing about political campaigns, it's our job to try to keep you honest. And if you're going to just dismiss what we're saying, then we're going to keep on trying to do it, and we're going to move it higher and higher in our stories, and we're going to emphasize the fact that we're going to keep you honest and see what comes of it.
And just to underscore what you said, Neil Newhouse, Romney's, I'm not sure it's his sole pollster, but a pollster for Romney said that their campaign is not going to be dictated by fact checkers.
Yeah. No, yeah. He's also the guy who did the jump the shark comment. I mean, it's no surprise that campaigns don't want to be dictated by fact checkers, but it was a little bit shocking how blatant this sort of statement was. Like, sorry, go ahead and tell us that we're lying. We're going to bet that America just doesn't care.
And I don't mean this as a partisan question, but is it, and do we know enough? And is it even fair to ask? Is one party, and here I am like looking for the euphemism, is one party more dishonest than the other?
I think all politicians lie. I think, honestly, that's the answer. And, you know, if to be completely honest, I think that journalists tend to, well, not that they tend to put more emphasis on the lies that Republicans tell, but I think the stories that are written about the lies Republicans tell get more play online and in the political blogosphere because I think that generally trends left. So I think those are the stories that get the attention. But if you were to actually, put the Republicans and Democrats on a scale, I think they'd pretty much even out in terms of the lies they tell. That's just a sense. I could be wrong here.
Fair enough. That doesn't get said every day. You have to realize that, Justin.
Yeah.
that someone could actually be wrong. Let me get to James from Elkton, Maryland to join us. James, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
I don't understand. I'm frustrated by why journalists struggle so much with the word choice to use for these lies or untruths that are told. It seems to me that the content of what is said and what is not said is part of the story. So why not take the time to articulate a real analysis of what's being said?
Well, and in part, that's what these fact checkers, at least, are trying to do. Justin, your thoughts?
Yeah, and I think I would direct you towards places like PolitiFact. It's politifact.com and factcheck.org, where they've got dedicated teams of researchers who do nothing but parse political statements and write these long sort of disquisitions on what was said, what was correct, what was not. Now, the great thing about places like PolitiFact is that they are not, the reporters there aren't really working on deadline. You know, it's more of a feature type thing, so they can take all the time they need to write these, well, not like all the time they need, but they've got time to research and write these stories, whereas someone writing for daily newspaper or a website is usually working out a very tight deadline. I interviewed the woman from the Washington Post who wrote the Day One story for about Paul Ryan's speech last week. She told me she had a 10:45 p.m. deadline to turn in her story. Ryan didn't even get finished speaking until 11 p.m., you know? So when you're working under really quick turnarounds like that, it is hard to be able to take the step back that you really do need to analyze these statements and really sort of pick them apart. I think there are things that newspapers can do to make it easier for those parts to appear in these stories. They could put together ad hoc newsroom teams that, you know, as these speeches are going on, these people are researching the claims and coming up with paragraphs that then they can just slot in to these stories. That's one example. But
And let me just stop there, because a lot of times the pundits and journalists, they get the speeches beforehand, or at least a little bit beforehand.
Oh, yeah. No, you're right. Usually they get excerpts of the speeches hours beforehand, and depending on who is speaking, they'll have the prepared remarks either about 30 minutes before the speech goes on, or right as the speech happens.
Well, Justin, they're playing my song. We have to end our discussion. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, it was a real treat, Marty.
And you're welcome. And that's Justin Peters, editor-at-large for Columbia Journalism Review. He's been writing about fact-checkers. He has worked at the Washington Monthly and has written for Slate, the Boston Globe, and the New York Times. We began with Dave Leventhal, money and politics reporter for Politico. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, but stay with us. We'll be right back.